Richard? Don't worry, you can just speak. There's microphones in the ceilings, apparently.
Oh, OK. All right. I'll try and speak clearly. I guess one for me then to kick off, Simon, if that's all right. So you touched on the enhanced partnership with Zalando that's getting going in the second half. What have you built in terms of H2 guidance, in terms of sort of sales uplift from the single inventory view or better service options for customers? And I suppose following on from that, where do you see the biggest geographic and sort of convenience opportunities coming from that partnership? Is it possibly broadening scale in Eastern Europe, or is it, I think you called out parcel shops, lockers, those sort of convenience options? Are there sort of some things that Zalando does very well that Next could benefit from in time?
The last question is yes. Obviously, they have parcel shops pretty much everywhere, and they have parcel shops in lots of locations that we don't have them. And there are other good, you know, services and customer bases that they effectively talk to, particularly as a result of their recent acquisition as well in Eastern Europe. We're excited about that. Have we built it into our forecasts? No. And nor should we, by the way, because... No, and because it would be a big mistake, by the way, because, and this is a conversation I've had many times with our operations teams, is I cannot think of a single warehouse transition. You know, you look at Elmsall 3, you look at the Middle East, we just talked about those, where the transition itself has not caused some degree of sales disruption. So I think it'd be, we haven't built any disruption into our sales numbers for the period of the transition, which is sort of July, August, September, but also we haven't built in any uplift from the possible benefits. And I think that is the right place to be at the moment on that.
Yeah. I'd love to ask a question on AI, but it's a bit more mundane on stores. You talked about a new store format in Stratford.
Thurrock.
With the new stores that you're opening, are they all going to be in this new format going forwards? And do you have to refit many of your existing estate over maybe a 10-year period for that new format? And with that, the buzzword you didn't get in is RFID today. Is there any hope that you could use RFID in terms of your increasing the efficiency in those stores with higher cost of personnel to get the RFID in the garments so that you can do your returns to store, you can recycle things much more effectively? Is that things that you're thinking about in terms of the new store format?
Yes, two good questions. I'll start with the first one, which is the new format. So first of all, you know, the new format is not a new religion. You don't have to go around forcing conversion on everyone. That doesn't work either for religion or in stock shop fit terms. So we will absolutely not go back and be refitting our old stores with the new format, but we will be using it going forward in any new openings that we have. In terms of RFID, we already use RFID in our stores. We don't put it on the garments. We put it on the security tag, and then we associate that garment with the security tag when it goes into the store. That gives us, we think, 95% of the benefit of RFID without the cost of having to put RFID tags into all of our clothes, the vast majority of which, because they're online, wouldn't use it. So in terms of cost effectiveness, at the moment, we think it's much more effective to use security tags as RFID. Gives us quick stock counts, shop floor availability, all sorts of exciting things. But we're not looking at RFID for company wide at the moment, unless it drops in cost dramatically. Good.
Yeah. Hi, Jeff Lowry, Redburn. Just fascinated by your disclosure and conversation around new customer growth. Pre-COVID, you put up a slide talking about maturity curve of customers from sort of year zero up to year five. I wondered if that had changed very much over the years and whether you were seeing anything very different internationally to the UK in terms of that build after year one of acquisition.
Yeah, so I think it's too early to say, is the honest answer. You know, if you look at the rate at which we're growing our business overseas, there are so many new customers that trying to use the customers we had 4 years ago to predict what the customers we're recruiting today, many of whom are in different countries from the ones we recruited 4 years ago, I could give you numbers, but they would be completely meaningless.
Is there a curve at all?
There is definitely a curve. There always is. It does depend very much what product group they come in to buy. It's very different maturity curve if someone comes to buy children's wear than if they come in to buy women's wear. But we've got no meaningful information on that.
Hi, it's Woolworths from Bernstein. When you look at the 25% increase in the marketing spend internationally, I think on the map you highlighted new countries that you were going to spend money in. What's the rough split between investing in the countries you're already spending in versus the new ones? And I suppose to link to the previous question, are you seeing good repeat purchasing behaviour from those that you've acquired? Mm. And I suppose does that, if you thought about them, lifetime value or something like that, are you seeing good return on that, not just on the ad spend?
So I think in answer to the first question, the vast majority of the increase in spend, of the spend, full stop, will come in existing territories, where we've already got most territories. The biggest percentage increases in spend will come in the newer territories, but it'll still be relative to the, because the sales are so much smaller, it will be a smaller number and therefore a smaller amount of that 25%. increase. In terms of sort of long-term value of customers, I think there are two points I make. One is, you know, kind of similar to Jeff's answer, we don't yet know. And I suppose the other answer is not that we don't care, it's that the important thing is that we get the return on the sales that we can see within the 18 months. And as long as we're getting our 50% return on the investment, it would be a lovely thing if those customers then went on to deliver far greater return than that beyond it. But actually, that's not the point, is that we're not banking on that. Our hope is that it will, but we don't yet know.
Oh, hi, Monique Pollard from Citi. I just had a question on the use of the third-party aggregators. When you look internationally, as you mentioned, the growth from the third-party aggregators is actually higher than what you're driving on your own website. So just wondering what learnings you've taken from, you know, yourselves being on the third-party aggregators that you can use with your third-party brands on your website to drive that faster sales growth.
No, it's a good question. I think, you know, stock, it comes down to things that are really not rocket science. Ultimately, stock availability. Right. Yeah, selecting the right stock to put on the aggregator site and then making sure you're properly stocked of it. Because unlike our own websites, we don't have the fail-safe of being able to deliver the stock from the UK. So getting stock levels right is super important. And that kind of leads into what I was alluding to about the provision of third-party services on warehousing logistics. Is if the trial is successful this year, and if we're able to genuinely add value and cost savings and improve service for clients through the warehousing logistics business, we think there is a further benefit for them and ultimately us as well through consolidating their stock in one place, because that will improve availability on our website.
And could that theoretically then, you know, your pathway to increasing the utilization of your new warehousing, could that be far quicker if, for instance, these trials work and you end up with a lot of utilization?
Theoretically is the key word in your question, and the answer is yes, theoretically, but there's a huge amount of hard work and reality between the theory and practice. So, I don't think we'll have any news on that, you know, a meaningful news for 18 months to 2 years, because I think it will take us that long to get a trial up and running, establish the systems, get the controls that need to be in place to look after other people's stock for them, integrate, cost, make sure we're making money out of it, and then roll it out. So theoretically it's true, but it will take time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, it's Georgina Jonan from JP Morgan. Just a question on AI, please. In terms of how you're using it within your tech in particular, and with the conversations that you're having with the providers of that AI, do you think that you are ahead of peers in terms of using it, or, you know, just a comparative level? And also in terms of like the cost of that AI, and excuse my ignorance here, but like, is it prohibitive for a smaller player or not? So like going forward over time, do you expect this to be able to sort of widen your differential being a scale player already, or actually will that differential narrow because AI can be used as kind of incremental support from smaller and growing?
Yeah, honest answer to that is I don't know, because you know One of the ways that we run Next is, like, you know, we stay in our lane and we focus on where we're going. And we don't spend too much time looking over our shoulders at what other people are doing, unless there's something to learn from it. So I've got no idea how far we are down the journey compared to major competitors. And I'm not really, all I'm interested in is what can it do for us and can we make the best use of it, rather than getting too hung up on whether it provides a moat or a USP or an advantage, because even if it does provide those things, they won't last. And the important thing is what we are doing for our customers and our business, not whether we're ahead or behind the pack. I'd be very disappointed if we were behind the pack, but you know it's possible.
Yeah, right, John Stevenson at Peel Hunt. Quick question on the consumer. You've talked at peak about people sort of choosing to spend more on products and sort of buy less. Is that still continuing? To what extent is that sort of informing, you know, how consumers are feeling at the moment?
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, I think the buying fewer, better garments is nothing to do with economics. Yeah, I think it would be a huge mistake to regard that as being something to do with levels of affluence, because ultimately, we're not saying that customers are spending any more money. In fact, you can see they're on average are spending 1% more in the UK. It's about what they're choosing to spend their money on, and I think there's been a slight reversion from buying lots of throwaways type stuff to buying fewer, more considered investment garments. But that has nothing to do with how the consumer's feeling. It's all to do with sort of, you know, macro fashion trends rather than any economic trends.
Does that feed through into sort of how you think about sort of good, better, best and the sort of structure of the range going forward?
Yes, I mean, we don't think about it in a global sense, you know, because we have literally, you know, tens of thousands of garments on our ranges. We have, and it's not my job to think about the balance between better and best, because it's the job of the dress buyer and the socks buyer and the baby grow buyer. It's their job is to work out what is the best balance between their mid entry and exit price points, and whether they should push those price points further or lower. All I'm really doing is taking the credit for their hard work. I'm not directing it.
Anne Critchlow from Berenberg. Could you talk a bit about the trend through the current trading period? Because I imagine March was probably stronger than February, and whether March informed your upgrade in guidance. And secondly, if you could talk in broad terms about the performance of home relative to clothing. I know you don't normally comment. And then, sorry, a third one as well, if that's all right.
Well, because we're getting, you're not going to get an answer to the first two, so let's go for one. I can ask.
If you could comment a bit on the London office space you're taking, what that's for and where it's going.
Yeah, OK, so I'll start with a question I can answer, or I'm prepared to answer. The London office space is mainly for the Wobble brands, wholly owned brands and licences. That's the vast majority of that is to accommodate the growth of those new and developing businesses. We don't ever discuss the relative performance of our different product areas, other than at very high level, like between, you know, Wob and Next, we'll talk about it, but otherwise we don't discuss home versus other areas. I think the only thing that might be useful to say is I think in general, if you look at the home market generally, it has been through, had a fantastic 18 months in COVID, has had a sort of 2.5-year, 2-year hangover. It appears to be out of that hangover now. So we're more encouraged by what we've seen on home sales. And then will we give a week by week, blow by blow detail of what we took in February, March? No. Sorry.
Hi. Can I ask on the third party platform where you sell third party aggregators where you sell in the Next brand? Do you sell the ranges that you're selling on them? Are they any different to what you're selling on the Next direct websites? And the same in reverse on the third party brands that are sold on the Next platform. How much are those exclusive to Next? And are you actively working with these brands to develop exclusive ranges?
So in terms of difference in performance, we do see significant difference in performance, not necessarily on a garment by garment basis. It's not that kind of the red dress sells well in Denmark and the blue one sells well in Spain. It's more that the product mix by territory is very different. Countries are dominated by kids' wear sales. Others aren't dominated in the same way by kids. So it's those sort of mixed changes that we see both on our own websites and with aggregators. In terms of third-party brands, the vast majority of our third-party branded business on aggregators are the brands that we own, because obviously the ones that we don't own tend to be trading already on their own account on those aggregators. You know, if you're Nike, you go straight to Zalando or About You, you don't come to Next to put airline. So the third party business is much smaller on overseas business, and the growth is focused on the Wobble brands.
Thank you, Simon. Sridhar Mantali from UBS. Three questions, if I may.
Two questions. We're not having any inflation here. There's a war against inflation in this country.
Overseas margins, up nearly 200 basis points last couple of years. Can you talk through on the midterm potential here? Because this year you're talking about operating leverage, driving margins up, leveraging the fixed overheads. Is there a sort of philosophical point where you say you don't want these margins to be going up further into mid to high teens and so on and so forth? Secondly, I think on surplus cash flow, given you've accumulated what you need to with the 250 million bond, then potentially no need to retain any of the surplus cash going forward. Should we be assuming all of it to be returned to shareholders steadily, or subject to M&A, of course, but yeah, is there anything else we should be thinking about?
Yes, it's a really good question. As are all the questions today, obviously. So first of all, on margin, don't assume that, you know, that margins will go much higher than where we intend to get them to this. Yeah, we want to get the right balance in having a healthy business that can fund its marketing and being, you know, over profiting. So I wouldn't expect margins on our overseas businesses to increase faster than to go above where they get to this year. That certainly wouldn't be the plan. If anything, they're more likely to come down solely because of the mix between aggregators, where we make less margin, and our own sites, where we make more. And because aggregators are growing faster than our own site, I would actually expect the net effect of those two things to push down the margin. But in terms of the margins of the aggregation business and the next business, I think we've got both of those to where we're comfortable with at the moment. Then in terms of surplus cash, I think I don't want to talk too much about sort of beyond this year. So I think this year we said if we can get extra cash resources, we will return full amount of surplus cash. I think there is then an argument to say that, you know, in order to maintain our investment grade, we don't need to have, we could take on more debt. And I think if we do that, we will do it slowly and gradually over a 4 or 5 year period, rather than go out and borrow a great big slug of money and return it all to shareholders. Because if we do the latter, the chances are we'll get the timing horribly wrong. But I think the most important thing, because there is an underlying reality to it, is that we're not prepared to put in jeopardy our investment grade credit rating. That is a sort of red line for us. Yeah, one more.
BNP Paribas Exane. Simon, is there any level of critical mass in overseas markets where you'd consider opening physical stores to build the brand more broadly?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's not about critical mass. It's about, does that store in that country make a profit? I think our experience has been the experience, you know, like those flies you see flying into a window pane. And it doesn't matter how many times they do it, they just keep trying to do it again. And that our experience of opening stores overseas has been like that. The only time the window has been open is where somebody else has done it on our behalf through a franchise. So currently, you know, we are looking with our partner Myntra. They are looking at opening stores on our behalf in India. I think to try and do that, I think to try and open your own stores in territories where you don't understand pitch, you don't have a relationship with the landlords, you're unlikely to take the same pounds per square foot as local competitors whose brands are 100% locally appropriate, I think is slim for a brand at Next's position in the market. You know, Reese makes a profit trading some stores overseas, but it's been tough there as well. But you know, they do make a profit, so that's I would not say never, but we certainly have no plans to do it at the moment. And I'd much rather do it through a licensee, even if it means taking a smaller percentage of the profit. I'd much rather do it through a franchise or license than directly. And I think on that note, we've exhausted all the questions. Thank you very much.